Okay. Okay, the questions. I can't get away from that one.
There you go. Okie dokie, thank you so much. Here we go. I have found in this retreat that the key to a successful meditation is a happy, positive mind. In the real world, we are often unavoidably surrounded by negative people who often practice bad speech and bad actions, expect to follow, to fit in. How do we maintain our meditation when real world conditioning is not conducive? Come on. This is the real world. Out there tomorrow, you'll be going back to the fake world. In monasteries and temples, we don't wear deodorant. We keep it real. We don't wear makeup. You're as you see them, that's how we are. We don't wear hair pieces, wigs, breast implants. What else can you get? Botox. You call this the real world? Outside is the fake world. And you have reality TV shows. Is that reality? That's still fake. So much in the world, just go to a shopping center. It's all fake. Air conditioning, you never get cold, you never get hot. You never really feel the rain. You've got umbrellas and you live in cars. You never get out into the real world. This is the real world. You're going back to the fake world when you go over there. People are always pretending, putting on faces, trying to impress one another, never being real. And you call that the real world? To me, that is so false and fake and deceptive. Over there, when you go out, do people always tell the truth? Of course not. It's a fake world. But here, people are honest. So this is the real world. So I love that when people say, out there in the real world, that's the fake world. This is the real world. But it's true. In the fake world, you are surrounded by negative people who often practice bad speech and bad actions and expect you to follow to fit in. You don't have to fit in with them. They have to fit in with you. And in fact, if you don't follow them, they actually really respect you. And they think, wow, this Buddhism and meditation actually works. They respect where you have been. And they think this is a path where people don't have to be so negative. So you don't allow yourselves to get pulled from the real world where you've been to out into the fake world of criticism and judging. They can't do that. So, this is the real world. And when you go back out there into the fake world, always remember this place. You're not in the fake world all the time. You're only in there for a few hours a day. And anyway, you're at your computer terminal or you're doing something or other. You're not with people all the time. And so that you can be peaceful and happy. And you find that that is the real work ethic. Not to get things done, but to do them with happiness, with peace, with energy, with joy. It's not what you achieve, but how you do the work is really important. And that way, you will be a successful person, and you will bring the real world into the fake world of the shopping centers and the offices, and all of the accounting firms. So see if you can bring the real world back with you when you go to your fake houses and fake offices and fake cars. The Ajahn, what changes in a person are indicators of someone on the path to stream winning? The first change is an indicator is you don't ask questions such as this. So I'm sorry, whoever wrote that question. There are a lot of times you don't know. I always loved the story of the little novice, Sumano the novice. And he was only this little fellow, and sometimes the monks would tweak his ears, knock him on the head, just to get him to do stuff for them. And when the Buddha was on arms round and saw them knocking this little novice on the head, he called a meeting of all the monks and said, "You do not know what you've been playing around with. That novice is a fully enlightened arahat with enormous psychic powers." The Buddha said he'd just been off into the Himalayas and did a battle with his fierce naga and defeated the naga. Now, that's always interesting stuff. It's like some super movie. But doesn't matter, he was a powerful novice and he was fully enlightened. And he said, "Don't play around with such powerful beings." And that's where the Buddha gave that great simile of the four small things you should always treat with respect. Small princes, because one day they may become the king, and they remember what you did to them. Or the children and grandchildren of presidents of the United States. Same category, be careful. And small fires, because we know this very well here in Western Australia, because a small little fire can be this huge bushfire, which can burn down Jhana Grove, the monastery, the Nuns Monastery, everything. So small fires are very dangerous. And the other next one was small snakes. Because even though they're tiny snakes, they can still be venomous. So, you know, just because they're small, don't think that they're safe. And lastly, small monks and nuns. Just because they're small, like Venerable Analia over there, don't think she's a pushover. Be careful what you say to her. One glance of her eyes, and then you'll be fried. Isn't that true? Look at her. She looks so sweet and harmless. That is what the Buddha was actually pointing at. You never know. So the point was that even the monks, they didn't know who was an arahat, who wasn't. And I was playing around with this little novice who was. So the people who are stream winners, no one ever lets on who they are. You don't wear a special coat or a hat or have stripes on your arms. One stripe for first jhana, two for second jhana, three for third jhana. A pip on there for the fourth jhana stream winner. We don't do that. We keep it quiet. So nobody knows. Nobody tells. Dear Ajahn, your talk this morning really hit a spot for me, and it's still sore. No? That's what I said. And it almost made me cry, which is a big deal for me. Wow. It made me realize how cruel and harsh I'd been to myself. Probably still is. For constantly comparing myself. This is something I won't do to others. How can I be more compassionate to myself? Very easy. You know, these days it's very hard to give a hug to anybody. You know, you hug somebody and they sort of take you to the court for sexual abuse. I wanted to hug you and say, okay, monks can't hug girls. If I hug boys, it's the same. They think I'm gay. So what? You can hug a teddy bear, thank goodness. You can't hug kids anymore. So for all those people who haven't got anyone to hug you, and especially if you're in, say, Hong Kong during a bird flu crisis, you don't want to hug anyone, you might catch something. So if you want someone to hug, follow me, put your hands out. Hands out. Come on, Ananda, you can do it too. And follow me, bring them in. Ooh, God, really put some effort into it. Ooh, that feels really good. Yay! It works. That's how you start loving yourself. And why do people resist that? It's amazing just why people resist that. The thing is said, I'm superior. I don't need to love myself. Yes, you do. The people who found that difficult, you're the people who need to do it more. I had really bad dreams when I started the retreat, but later I was okay. Oh. Bad dreams are great. Always keep a piece of paper by your bedside, write them down, and that can be the basis of the script for the next horror movie coming out of Hollywood. You have great ideas when you have bad dreams. So why not? Make use of them. But anyway, later I was okay. What is the reason for this? Is it because the mind is defiled? It's not defiled, it's just the mind is agitated. And it hasn't had many positive inputs when you're out there in the fake world. Here in this real world, so many nice people, kind people. No one ever criticizes you. You're not told off. Have you ever been told off yet during this retreat? You know, for banging the doors or for coming in late or for chanting out of key or to anything like that? You deserve to, but you never have. Isn't that wonderful that we don't tell people off? Because if I did tell people off for chanting out of key, I'd get worse from you for chanting out of key. So this is why we don't judge anybody. It's people being people. So that way we're positive. Don't judge. And that means we have beautiful dreams. Non-judgmental dreams. You know, somebody told me of this little book in German, so I couldn't read it myself. It was a story of, it was actually stories of people who had out-of-the-body experiences. You know, dying, sort of going off towards the light, and then sort of being told it's not your time and coming back again. And this particular story was fascinating because a little twist to it, which you'll find out in a minute or two. It was a young German boy, maybe 8 or 9, 10 years of age, somewhere around that age, who died in some accident or an operating table, I can't remember what. And he remembered leaving his body. Obviously he came back afterwards to tell the tale. Leaving his body, just walking through this forest, a long way. And any German nationals know that the German people have got a very, very strong association with forests. Now, they were forest people for so many centuries. And so, walking through the forest, and they came to this hut. And there was a guy there with a book. What's your name? He checked. And you're not down in the book. You're not supposed to die. You have to go back. And this is actually how the little boy related it. But the guy said, well, seeing as though you're here, you can see how it works. And so the next person to arrive was a farmer. And the farmer came, oh, your name's in the book, and I just need to ask you a few questions. You know, have you ever lied and cheated and killed anything? And he said, no, not at all, I've been a very good man. And this inquisitor, this whatever, judge, whatever, turned around to this kid and said, see, even when he's dead, he still lies through his teeth. And as they were asking more questions of this farmer who was telling porcupines, which is Australian for lice, he saw this other person just go way past the shed and way up into the air. And the little kid said, why aren't you asking that man what he did? And that's when the judge or whatever said, throughout that man's whole life, the one who went right past, he's never judged anybody or criticized them, therefore I'm not going to judge him. And I thought it was wonderful. Then the 7-year-old just walked back and came to and told that story. I thought it was wonderful that this man who never criticized, judged, put people down, went straight past any inquisition or judgment, straight to a heavenly realm. That's how the little boy remembered it. So it's very beautiful. Why do you want to judge other people? Because then, if you do judge other people, then you will judge yourself. What you do to others is what you do to yourself. So you forgive, you make mistakes, you've done stupid things, we all do that. So just, we totally let it go. In yesterday's Vedana question, what I meant was about your talk about suffering rising, suffering passing away. As the only reality, independent origination, wanted you to share more on this. suffering rising and suffering passing away. This, one of the really powerful statements about this, was the enlightened nun, I think it's Wajira, and Mara, this guy who always wants to sort of spoil everything, gets really upset when people get enlightened, because they're letting go, he's got no control over them anymore. And came up to this bhikkhuni, this nun, saying, who do you think you are, enlightened person? And he said, you're not enlightened. And she said, who are you talking to? He said, I'm talking to you. He said, what do you mean, you? It's just five khandhas, that's all. And he said, and the nun said, all it is, all that life is suffering arising, suffering passing away. That's all there is. And the Maharaj said, oh, I can't argue with this one. And just went away to try another bhikkhuni who he might have some more control over. But I always remember that because that is the saying in the experience of an enlightened being. That, oh, okay, I'm going to... Oh, it's okay, I think I can share it with you. Sometimes I check if people understand the Dhamma. I say, if you're enlightened, an enlightened being, do you experience suffering? And some people say, no, 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 you're enlightened, you're happy, you've gone past suffering. And I realize you haven't understood the Dhamma. An enlightened being... That's all they experience. Suffering arising, suffering passing away, but no one experiencing that suffering. Just suffering arising, suffering passing away. Which is one of the reasons why it's only at parinibbana, when the enlightened being passes away, that's the time when suffering ends. That's why in those wonderful parts of the early Buddhist teachings called the Theragata and Therigata, these are experiences of people who were enlightened, both men and women. And they always say that once you're enlightened, it's like you're a workman or a workwoman waiting for their wages. You've done the job, you don't need to work anymore, but you only get paid at parinibbana. That's when you die, you disappear, you're gone. In the meantime, it's just suffering arising, suffering passing away. And then it finally passes away and doesn't arise anymore. That's parinibbana. That's why if you ever do go to the four physical places called the places of pilgrimage, Lumbini, where the Buddha was born, that's not really important. Where the Buddha was enlightened, oh, that's my number two best spot. Where he gave his first sermon, But the most important place, which is a place which is not respected as much as the others, is Kusinara. That is where the amazing thing happened. That is where suffering ended. Different way of looking at things. So this is just all there is, suffering arising, suffering passing away. You've got to make sure that there's nobody think that they're experiencing that suffering. There's not a being. Once you see that, suffering rises, suffering passes away. When the five khandhas, when the body dies, that's it. That our suffering has passed away. Bye-bye. So anyway, I don't know if you understand that, you're all looking totally confused. But anyway, let that suffering of confusion pass away. What did the Buddha practice in his previous life as a bodhisattva before he attained Buddhahood? Was it the sixth paramita? Any sutras which I can refer to? Kindly advise. Yes. The sixth paramitas came much later, after the time of the Buddha. That was Mahayana. And then after the sixth paramitas, the Theravada, they also came in with 10 paramitas, 4 more. You know, just to be, I'm better than you are, na, 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 na. And that's why sometimes people have actually asked me that question. Monks, bhikkhus, we have 227 precepts. So why do nuns have to have 318 precepts? That's unfair. It's discriminating. Why do they have to have more precepts? And I ask them, because the more precepts you have, the higher you are. 8 precepts are always superior than 5 precepts. 10 precepts, that's novices, monks and nuns, they're always superior. So surely 318 must be superior than 227. Isn't that the case? Do you agree with that? Sorry, 311, whatever it is. Do you agree with that? If they said yes, I would say, okay, answer the rest of the question. You know my trick.
Yeah.
But the real truth of the matter, I love saying this because there's so many myths around Buddhism. And already mentioned Gatikara Sutta. Ghatikara, Sinna Majjhima Nikaya. There the Buddha was giving this story about Gatikara, who was a potter, very poor, but he was also an anagami, that's the third stage of enlightenment. And the only reason why he didn't become a monk was because he had parents who were blind, and they depended on him. So he had to look after them. And he was also a student at the time of the previous Buddha, Kassapa. So, and this is a great snapshot of people say, well, how do you know if a person, say, a non-returner, an anagami? This is a sort of way that Gatikara lived his life. It gives you an understanding of the sort of things you expect of a non-returner. He would make pots for a living, but he would never dig the earth in case he hurt a little worm or a beetle underneath the soil. He would wait for earth to be dug up by rabbits or mice, or for the people who were making the dikes in the paddy field, and ask for some of the clay. And that's how he made his pots. And he wouldn't sell the pots. It was all done by donation, just like Jhana Grove. So, you know, we don't sell things, except Mahinda over there selling the books and stuff. Shows he can't be another. He's our librarian. But he just put the pots on the shelf and say, if you want a pot, take one. If you want to leave some rice and some lentils, maybe the basic stuff to feed me and my two parents, please leave some. And of course, people understood, and they always made sure he had enough for himself and his parents, and that's how he got by. So totally unworldly. And that's just how he lived his life. But he had a best friend called Jodipala, and he was always trying to get his best friend to go and see the Buddha. Just like you have maybe good friends, maybe a husband or wife. Say, come and listen to some Dharma. Look at the YouTube. Read a book. Do some meditation. It'll be really good for you. But does your husband or your wife or your friend actually come? Say, nah, I'm not into that. I'm going to watch the football on the TV instead. So there are some people like that. They're not really into religion, especially in Buddhism. And this was one of those people, Jodipala. And in fact, when this Gatikara, his best friend, said, this is not an ordinary person, this is a Buddha. The Buddha, just in the forest close by, Kassapa the Buddha. And then this Jodipala, he actually bad-mouthed, he scolded. They're just shaven-headed, good-for-nothings. You know, like sometimes people criticize the monks. They should go and get a proper job instead of sponging off other people. And they cook their own food. Get out there in the real world. It's a fake world, but they say, go and get a job like everybody else. So, he scolded Kassapa the Buddha. And then, this Gatikara, he went to extreme lengths. And then Jodipala eventually said, well, look, you know, you're really almost sacrificing, you know, our friendship with what you're doing. This Kassapa Buddha must be something special. Okay, I will go and see him. And so Jodipala went to go and see Kassapa the Buddha, and as you would expect, as soon as he went to see him, this was really a special person. And Jodipala, not having the hindrance of having to look after two blind parents, he ordained, became a disciple under Kassapa the Buddha. So Jodipala, that's how Jodipala became a disciple of Kassapa the Buddha. And when the Buddha told that story, he said, that was me. Jyotipala in my previous life, a previous life. I was Jyotipala. So that shows, and that has to be, by any calculations, a very close life to the Buddha Sakyamuni, his last life. Has to be very close. And in fact, there is also a corroborating story, because in the Devaputta Samyutta, that was one of the people who came down to congratulate the Buddha. This is our Buddha Sakyamuni on his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. Gatikara, Anagami, up in the Sudarvasa, came to see the Buddha, our Buddha, and say, yeah, we were best friends before, we lived in the same village. I became Anagami, and now you're a Buddha. Congratulations, old friend. And these two old friends congratulated each other. And that's a beautiful story, and that pretty much shows you that so-called bodhisattvas, Buddhas to be, can be so dumb in a close life, they don't even recognize as a Buddha in their vicinity. So that was one of the past life stories, real past life stories of Siddhartha Gautama. Very close. Told by our Buddha. Really nice, because that takes away a lot of the myths about the path to being a Buddha. Dear Ajahn Brahm, today I went into the dining hall with my shoes on.
You didn't, did you? Wow.
What are you laughing at? Always, if you give a talk, always overreact. Had a drink and a bite to eat and went outside again before I realized what I had done. My concern is, what level of offense was that? Oh, that's way up there. A serious breaking standard of a level 1-4 breaking of Bianca's rule. Nobody seemed to notice and no one told me they did. I wonder if anyone else has done this. Maybe we could start. I left my shoes on, club. Some people feel so, I don't know, if somebody might be just playing a bit of a joke on me there, but some people feel guilty over the smallest of things. The only reason we take our shoes off, you know, is because of cleanliness, so you don't have to clean the floor so much, and it's also the custom. But actually somebody asked me, just, why is it that when you go into a Buddhist temple, like in Nolamao, to listen to a talk, why do you have to take your shoes off? And I found out the answer when it happened, I think, to George Bush. He said, when you take your shoes off, it means if I say something bad, you've got nothing to throw at me. Because that's what they did with George Bush, they throw shoes at him. So that's why, please keep them outside. And some of the jokes I say, I think I will get quite a few shoes at me. No big deal. To Ajahn, how to overcome conceit for being such a good meditator or a good speaker? If you're referring to me, just go out and just associate with Australian builders. If you have any conceit at all, you are soon pulled down into the real world or the fake world. That's one thing you love about Australia. You know, that, you know, people, they can't be way up there and too conceited. They call it tall poppies and they bring you down straight away. So that's a great thing. In Asian countries, monks are treated, and, well, nuns, not yet, but it was coming, they treat you like princesses, and monks like royalty. And that's terrible. But I was telling the other day, the Japanese monk who was, he disrobed a couple of years ago, that was, what was his name again? Koizuka, Shibahashi. That was his name. It's always remember him because Ajahn Chah, being Thai, could not really speak Japanese. Shibahashi became Sibat Hasip, which means like $4.50 in Thai. And that became his nickname. He never got away from that, $4.50. Hey, $4.50, come over here. And anyway, he came to visit Perth. And he'd been in Thailand a long time. And so I took him to the airport, his Qantas flight going over to Sydney, carrying on his journey. And so, just like in any Australian airport, there was a queue of people waiting to check in. But he went right to the front of the queue. Because that's what you do in Thailand. You're a monk. You don't queue behind lay people, you go to the very front. And that's when I heard some words I haven't heard for a long time. Very rude words. And he soon learned that you're not conceited in Australia, it doesn't matter who you are. Get to the back of the line, you... That's really good. You know, that you're not treated like royalty over here. So, you know, I had to get dirty and work as well as anybody else. You said that even letting go is conditioned, then why do you call it free won't? If it's conditions, it's not free. It's not our choice to let go. And right effort isn't just letting go, abandoning. The other half of right effort is to cultivate the wholesome. Why is that not a doing? Because the only way in cultivating the wholesome is by letting go. Letting things be. Renouncing. You try and cultivate wholesome, it's like chasing the carrot. It always goes away from you. You relax and let be your default state. When you don't do things, it's wholesome. Doing stuff, I know many people who try to do compassion, trying to do a good deed, just like that old story of the Boy Scout, to do his one good deed of the day, he took an old lady across a busy road. The problem was, she didn't want to go. That is typical of like compassion when it's done. So anyway, it's letting go is conditioned by others. It's a free won't. And they said you can always stop things. You can always let go. That is, if you look at the right efforts, what I call the right endeavors, you look at it and it makes a lot of sense when it's a not doing, not a cultivating. If you cultivate things, you just get weeds. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you very much for building this retreat for us. I have a few amazing experiences and learned so much from you. Thank you. What are those experiences? You don't tell me. Okay, but thank you. Gratitude is one of the most amazing experiences. So say thank you. Say thank you to your parents. It doesn't matter, they may not be the best parents. But say thank you to them. Because when I was away on Sunday, doing the New Year celebration for the Thai community in Perth, that's one thing we did. We did a little sharing of merits with our deceased parents. And I'm a Westerner. Doesn't matter. I remember my mother passed away 5 years ago. My father passed away about 50 years ago. Remember them, visualize them. And said thank you for all the stuff you gave me and did for me. And then I shared merits with them. Such a beautiful thing to do. So that's saying thank you. And at any time, your parents may be dead a long time ago, you can still say thank you. But it's even better to say thank you when they're still alive. It means it's much more powerful. That's why, if any of you have ever seen any of the ordinations we do here, or in the nuns' ordinations, first part of the ordination, the Anagarika in white comes, we usually get the parents to come along, and they go and bow 3 times to their parents and ask forgiveness. And that's such a beautiful thing. Like Westerners, or was the last time when Sunyo, his parents came over from Holland. And for a Westerner to have their, first of all, their son bow to you. How many people, sons in Australia, bow to their parents? Australians. And mother usually cracks up, starts weeping. So beautiful, and say, thank you, mum and dad, for bringing me up, looking after me, sacrificing me. And that just goes right into the center of these European people's hearts. It's beautiful to see. So that's the sort of stuff which is, that's just a beautiful part of the ordination ceremony. Just saying thanks. So, that's a nice thing to do. So say thanks to your wife. To your husband. Thank you, darling, for all the wonderful things. It's not been easy to live with me. It's not. Take my word for it. I know what I'm talking about. Thank you, husband, for living with me. And then the husband says, yeah, well, I've got to thank you for putting up with me as well. But you thank each other. And it's such a beautiful act of gratitude. And it just softens people's hearts. And it's one of those lovely things. And so saying thank you to your teacher. I used to say thank you to Ajahn Chah. And you, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I've had it a couple of times, that first of all, the first teacher who taught me to get into these deep meditations, as soon as you come out of a deep meditation, I just wanted to kiss him, just kiss his feet. Thank you so much, what you've given me. Ajahn Chah, there was this monk, he was actually Ajahn Buddhadasa's main Western teacher for a while. And he came, I was in Bangkok, and he came right up to me, a Westerner, and that's what he did. He bowed down and started kissing my feet. I said, what the hell are you doing? He said, you don't remember, do you? I was the first person to teach him meditation. When I was up in, as a young monk up in Wat Nonachat in Thailand. He said, you gave me some great teaching on meditation. I've never forgotten those. Thank you. It was an American. And I was paying thanks to me. It was really weird, but I understood because I would want to do that to other people. So please keep off my feet. But you can understand that. You've got so much gratitude. The gift of the Dharma is just amazing. So that's why, you know, it brings people to tears. So that's thanks. But when I asked Ajahn Chah, I said, if you want to show me gratitude, say thanks. Just saying thanks is really not the way. Just go and practice what I've taught you. And if you're peaceful and happy and get something, you know, on the path, that's your way of playing gratitude. So the only way to thank a monk like me is for you to be a better Buddhist, kinder, more compassionate, more peaceful. To be nuns who get even more peaceful and kind towards one another, get into the incredible jhanas, get enlightened, and that's the way you say thank you, by following in the footsteps of your teacher. Instead of kissing the feet, follow the feet. Dear Ajahn, I once thought that listening to different teachers is a good way to cultivate an open mind. But if I'm conditioned by what I'm hearing, it scared me. How many wrong seeds I've already planted in my consciousness, especially nowadays. There is not much of real Dharma teacher. Moreover, what they're teaching are mixed with good and bad teachings. How can one know? That's the simile of being lost in the mist. You know, sometimes you can actually feel that, you know, it feels good. It feels like it's creating peace and happiness and compassion, lessening my anger, irritation. You see, it is leading in the correct direction. Therefore, it must be the teachings of the Buddha. But please don't follow a monk or a nun. We follow teachings. That was also with that Japanese monk, because he had so many disciples, and he actually disrobed suddenly, and many of those were, they were heartbroken. They'd given so much time, donations, and faith in this monk, and he disrobed. And they were just shocked. And some of them came to see me, and I told them that you never take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Ajahn Brahm. That's wrong. You take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And the Sangha is not just monks, it's nuns as well, they're Sangha. So that's our three refuges, not in personalities, but in what they represent. So please, you take refuge. This is not a guru tradition. Hail the great His Holiness Ajahn Donut. That's my nickname. It's a Sangha. That's really important. Dear Ajahn, thank you very much for your teachings. We are so blessed to have such a compassionate and kind teacher. Yes, that's the great, amazing Ajahn Brahm, the fourth refuge. Don't ever do that. You're asking for trouble, and also you're putting that monk or that nun on a pedestal which they don't deserve. Thank you for being at this moment now. Of course, I have to be here. Dear Ajahn, what are the rules for monastics touching the opposite gender? Can a monk give his mum or sister a hug? If not, this will be a grievance to his relations. Thanks. There is no prohibition against a monk touching a woman. Out of lust, yes, giving up. That's against the rules. But hugging your mum, the problem is that we have culture as well as rules. And this was a big problem. Because for years, you know, that because I was trained in Thailand, there was no way that I would even shake the hand of a woman. And you come to Australia, and that really offends people. And recently there was, if you read the news, there was cases of, I think, the Muslim population in Switzerland. They told their children when they went to high school, after a lesson, do not shake the hand of your teacher if it's the opposite gender. And that was such an ingrained custom. After a lesson, all the children would always shake the hands of their teacher. It was Swiss culture. And so when the Muslim children refused to do this, that was front page of the newspapers, not just in Switzerland, but all around the world. It was like cultural insensitivity. And like for years, that, you know, I told the monks, look, outside the monastery, if you're in some function and there's a mayor there, or there is some other dignitary, of course you shake their hands. There's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, you know, the Indian tradition, you know, if you have someone you respect, you actually touch their feet, man or woman. Even in Sri Lanka, you do that. That's when I first went to Sri Lanka, I thought, this is weird. You're not allowed to touch monks' feet. Those are women. They said, no, we respect you. Of course we can. And they were right. So, touching feet, shaking hands, that's not against the precepts at all. I get criticized for that by some monks, but here in Australia, I would never do it in Thailand, because that's Thai culture, you've got to fit in to that culture. But here in Australia, United States, you know, if someone puts out their hand, a woman, to shake it, then of course you shake it. Otherwise, you actually, you are destroying people's faith in Australia. And the other thing is that obviously if you're in France, you don't do the kissing both cheeks. I mean, that's a bit dangerous. But apparently one of the monks, he was in New Zealand and they went to like this Maori festival. And the Maoris, and you probably know them, you got to rub noses. So he had this beautiful Maori woman and he had to rub noses with her. So I'm glad there wasn't any cameras and showed in Thailand, he'd be in big trouble. But it was just the way of doing things. So this is actually what we do. Well, when my mother was alive, I was still sort of a bit afraid. So I'd always meet her, she'd always meet me at the airport, and I'd say, okay, Mum, you're allowed one hug when I first come, one hug when I leave. But wait a moment, I looked around, any Thai people there, no, hug. And of course you felt really sort of, you know, a bit guilty that you only gave your mum one hug. So these days, I mean, my mum's and mother's hug them all the time, I think. There's nothing wrong with that. It's adapting to the culture without getting into lust or without being misunderstood. That's the other thing, because of sexual abuse, sexual harassment, you have to be very, very careful, especially people in religious orders. Because ministers of religion, priests, you know, clergy, they've all, you've seen, have got into trouble with sexual abuse. So we have to be very careful. But we do have a sexual abuse policy, child abuse policy, you know, for the BSWA. So we do have a policy. If there are any accusations, this is what you have to do. You don't just dismiss it. Ah, it's Ajahn Brahm, he's okay. No, investigate it. Otherwise, you know, sometimes that's what happened with the Catholic Church and we're going into big trouble. So we have to be, and it happens, still happens in Thailand and in Sri Lanka. You know, sometimes the monks are untouchable. So an accusation, say, no, you can't criticize a monk, bad karma. But it's worse karma, as you all know, if you let a monk get away with that and there's no investigation. And when it does blow up, it really hurts. So please, if you see any person misbehaving, just let people know. How do you stop getting excitement when getting a nimitta? Is it possible to get an imitator within 5 minutes or 10 minutes? Second question first. Yeah, if you've been doing good meditation, of course the mind is so strong, so powerful, it comes up quite quickly, nimittas. It really depends on where you're starting from. If you come to a retreat the first day, very unlikely because you're really busy, your mind will be tired. But after a few days, nice peaceful time, not doing very much, your mindfulness is getting stronger, not doing so much, so the no is very strong, of course nimitta can come up quite quickly. And as you start getting excited, just like anything else, you've blown it so many times. Beautiful nimitta, and oh, I got excited. And you've got to work again until you get it back again. So after a while you learn not to get excited. Just you get feedback, you've blown it again. So after a while you become more careful. It's like the simile of the snake. I haven't told this one yet. I already mentioned this more yesterday about having to sweep the paths in the jungle so you did not see any, you did not step on any snakes. Because they were out there, especially at night time. But my stimulus of the snake was that many times, no batteries in the flashlight, no shoes to wear, so barefoot in the dark. Now, starlight, whatever you could get, a bit of moon sometimes, walking back through the jungle to your hut after a meeting. There were snakes there. And I knew there were snakes there. So because I knew there were a danger, I was always on the lookout for them. So when I was walking, I wasn't just whistling. I wasn't just dreaming or planning or writing my autobiography. I was looking really carefully at the path. And sometimes there'd be a black shape across the path. It could be just a shadow. But I wasn't going to take a chance. I'd go another route or jump over it. And that's why I never got bitten. And I always use that as a simile. Excitement is like a snake on the path. It can bite you. It can stop you enjoying the nimittas and going deeper. So if it's happened a few times, you're on the lookout for it. Yeah, you're meditating, you're starting to get peaceful, I better be on the lookout for excitement. That has bitten me many times. And once you're on the lookout for it, you see it before it actually catches you. And you can jump over excitement. You can go another path and get the nimitta but no excitement. If you're really aware of it as a problem, as a danger, then you can avoid it. A lot of times we're not really careful enough. Nimitta, nimitta, excitement comes again. You weren't looking out for it. So you get bitten again. That's my simile of the snake. Dear Ajahn, can you tell a story? Thank you. Another story. Stories help people become more happy, proven by scientists in the US. That's in the US. What about scientists in Australia? We're not all the same. Another story. Oh, I've got to think about a story. Oh, there was a story of this poor person who had a motorbike accident. And this happened when I was a kid actually. Had a motorbike accident and taken into the emergency room, giving an operation. When he came out, only then, it does happen, not very often, but it does apparently, they'd taken off the wrong leg. Amputated the wrong one. They didn't have any choice. Apparently these days, people actually, nurses tell me this is actually true, they actually write with a felt-tip pen, this one. because it's true, because there's so many people involved. Sometimes, you know, the messages get crossed. But this poor fellow, he got his wrong leg taken off, so they put him right back into the surgery to get the other leg off. And once he got well enough, he actually got a lawyer and he sued the hospital. Sued them. And he lost his case. He lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. And that was one of my father's jokes. And the reason I say it, because I remember, you know, just talking about gratitude to your father. And I remember him coming home one day and getting us all upset. And, oh, that's really bad. And he lost his case, that's unfair. How can he ever lose his case? He didn't have a leg to stand on. Ha, ha, ha. My father. Okay, Does that make you happier? Anyway, that's what they said here. If someone dies, passes away standing up, is this good? Thank you very much. If they die standing up, that's a weird question. But I suppose they could do that. Yeah, actually, I know many people who die standing up when they're hung. Yeah, they're standing up. Jesus died standing up. He was vertical when he died. Who else? Anyway, I better not go there. I'll be in trouble. But I know the funeral directors used to tell me that some people put in their will they want to be buried standing up. You know, with a vertical coffin instead of the horizontal coffin. I remember the funeral director saying, there's only a few weird people say this, and it causes them so much trouble. You know, because the hole has to be dug deeper and narrower. And just the little machine which they use to dig out the earth, it's actually made for digging trenches, not just holes. And so to do a vertical hole causes so much problems. So if you're one of these people who loves giving a hard time to your relations because they mistreated you, put that in your will. I demand to be buried standing up. That will just cause them so many headaches. But it's better actually not to cause anyone any headaches. Just go the normal way. But it reminded me of another story, because I had all these stories from funeral directors. And there was actually a monk who used to be a funeral director. He's Harry. He lives over in Sydney, in Campbelltown. And he was a funeral director for a little while. Great job, he said. But one day, they were called to collect the body in this small block of apartments in Sydney, an old block. And this old geezer had died, an old fellow. Sorry, I'm getting to my English. This old fellow, he's no top story, about fifth or sixth level in this apartment block. So they went up there. But, you know, they have this little stretcher which they take up there. And they could not get the stretcher horizontal in the lift. The elevator was just too small. So these two guys, now dressed in black, like funeral directors would do, what can we do? So the only thing they thought of was actually in the lift, the two on either side, holding the dead body in between them. You know, so you can imagine these guys in black, that's spooky enough, one on either side, and this old fellow who everybody knew had died. Because, you know, it's one of these apartments. People have been living there for years. They knew each other. So they knew he died. And so there they were, top story. And they pressed the button, praying that no one would interrupt the journey until they got to the ground floor and put him in the hearse. But, you know, one of the greatest laws of Dhamma is Murphy's Law. If it can happen, it does happen. And of course it did happen. No, the elevator, the lift, stopped halfway down. And there there were these two guys in black holding this dead guy in the middle. And when the doors opened, there's this little old lady was standing there. And then when she saw that this scene, she was almost speechless. But she was speechless, her face went white. But Harry, if that was his name, he said, I don't know how this happened, but we just lost control of the body, and the body started falling towards this old lady, and she fainted totally away. She collapsed. And Harry said, what can we do now? And they put the body back up, and they just closed the doors and went down. They had to leave the lady there. They had to hold this dead guy, first of all. And they rushed down, put it in the back of the hearse, and they rushed back up again to make sure the old lady was not another customer. But fortunately, she did survive. But that's the story. If it can happen, it does. And that wasn't like a setup. That actually happened. Poor old lady. Dear Ajahn Brahm, 007 Brahm, licensed to kill with kindness and bad jokes. Yeah, I was saying yesterday, I'm undercover. Because restraint of the five senses is an important cause of samadhi, what practical tips do you advise for lay life? I'd be happy to keep 8 precepts every day, but it's not practical. Unfortunately, mega gratitude for all the Dharma brainwashing. Where there's no will, there's a way. But one of the things is, you know, don't, if you can, limit watching TV, because that just draws you into a really fake world. So, you know, limit watching TV and get out into nature, away from the city, not in the shopping malls, but in the forest or the coast. That is just very good exercise and makes you really, really peaceful. And of course, hang out with really good people. Don't hang out with people who get you into bad ways. So those are wonderful ways where you can restrain the five senses. But restraining the five senses doesn't mean not having any fun. That's why living out in the forest, living out from the city, is already have restraint. Dear Ajahn, how to investigate when sexually fantasies come along during meditation? How to get rid of lust? If sexual fantasies come up during meditation, then write them down, give them to me, and I'll read them out. People will be very interested. They would wake up to listen to that when you get embarrassed. But no, the only reason why that happens is like it's cheap pleasure, you know, it's very easy, but after a while, in fantasies, you know, whatever your partner is always compliant, never argues, and you can always ride off into the sunset like in Disneyland, happy ever after. So when I had sexual fantasies, I started asking, then what? Then what? Then what? I'd move it along as fast as possible. Then what? Then what? And it would always be boring. Yeah, then what? Okay. Find a beautiful girl, you get married, then what? Well, then you, I don't know. And it's always, the process was the happy part, but the end result wasn't that good. And I always remember Ajahn Sumedho saying when he went to visit some old friends in Seattle where he grew up, and it was his school friend. And when she saw him, she said, "Ah, invite you to my wedding." And she was getting married for the 9th time. She said, "Why are you getting married for the 9th time?" And she said, "Well, look, I love just the dating process and the excitement of getting to know someone. And the amazing moment when they go down on one knee and they ask me, you know, will you marry me? And just, you know, the engagement ring and the planning of the big ceremony and all the relations are walking down the aisle. Oh, that is fantastic. It's what happens afterwards I don't like. So after the marriage ceremony is finished, we get divorced and I start again." You know, it's actually, you know, I quite admire that lady. You know, she was onto something. She's being honest. And that's just like fantasies. They only go to the meeting someone or winning the lottery or scoring the winning run for Sri Lanka in the World Cup cricket. But then they never go any further. Then what? So I like the then what's to stop sexual fantasies. And then they just go. And that's actually how we get rid of lust. Lust is a delusion. Saying that that person is the most beautiful person in the world. So how to get rid of lust is ask for a bottle of her you know what. Or if you're a guy, his you know what. And every time you have lust for him, and just take it out. Oh, that's my lover. Oh, everything about him is... So please be really careful. When you have boyfriends, don't squeeze him too hard. He's like toothpaste. Squeeze him too hard, it comes out the bottom end. Okay. Dear Ajahn, has the Buddha mentioned somewhere that it is an extremely rare thing for a being to become a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni in the samsara? Is that in the Dhammapada? They did actually say it's very rare to get a human life and also to meet the Dhamma and all that sort of stuff, but that's very much, you know, of that time, 2,500 years ago. These days it's quite easy to get a human birth. Look how many there are. And look how many sort of pregnancies there are right now. There are so many more rooms in the hotel. So it's quite easy to get a human rebirth these days, which is why the standard of humans has gone down. Too easy these days to get human rebirth. And where have all the humans come from? Look at all the animals, which are, you know, can't get rebirth in the animal realm because the animal population has been decimated. There used to be so many monkeys around in the forests and the jungles. Now there's not many forests or jungles anymore. So many of those monkeys have been reborn as your children. That explains so much. Where did all the gorillas go, you know, from Kenya and those highlands? They're all bikies. It's common sense. Anyway, I better carry on. This is a joke. It's about wrong view. Two elephants were in the jungle. This has got sounds promising. Two elephants were in the jungle. A naked man walked close by. An elephant said to the other, "I can't believe it. How does he feed himself by that?" Drunk, okay, naked man. That's a naughty joke. Shame on you. Shame on you. But it's very good. If you don't understand that, I'm very impressed with you. Do you understand that, lady? Yeah, you all understand it. Naughty nuns. I prefer Q&A where audience participates. This present format is becoming a parody, ironically similar to reality TV shows you dislike. Please, can we go back to discussion? The trouble with discussion is that some people run the discussions and other people don't say anything because people are scared. And they're sort of, especially in a big group of people. That's why the discussions, one-on-one in interviews, that's where we have the discussions. This is actually where a person can anonymously ask a question. And that gives you many more questions. But when we do have people putting their hand up, remember our recent AGM? And when you have, it's always the same person putting their hand up every time. It's not really a discussion, it's just listen to me. Ranajan, thank you very much for the most wonderful retreat. Every time I come here, it gets better. See, because you're brainwashed, it's working. Now you know that I am offender number one. This is a repeat question. Does the stream of consciousness at death get its data from the other consciousnesses through mind consciousness? How does the process of transfer of stream of consciousness to the new life from this life take place? The best simile is this that I've come up with. It's a hard thing to say, but it's the mango simile. You eat a mango today, and you put the seed in the garden. And that seed in the garden, you can see the process if you pay attention. That seed cracks, and a little green shoot comes out from that seed, and very slowly, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, pushes until it breaks through the surface of the soil. And it's just like a blade of grass when you first see it. But then it pushes more and more up, and its stem becomes wooden. You get tiny little leaves. It's a sapling. And day by day, it grows, and it's a small tree. You can see it as a small tree. And then it gets bigger and bigger, more and more branches, more and more twigs, more and more leaves. Until the time comes, it's big enough, you see its first flowers come out. And those first flowers, they get bigger and bigger, and the stem of the flower starts to swell small, and then it gets bigger and wider and fatter, and then it becomes reddened a little bit. It's a mango, and it's ripe to eat. It's a process. And the question is, what went across from the first mango to the new mango? You could see cause and effect, every time. You can see where the sapling came from a minute ago, 2 minutes ago, just growing very slowly. A cause and effect process, every part of that process you can see. But there's nothing went across. Probably even the chemicals in the first mango were probably totally different than the second mango. Even the DNA will be slightly different. There's always some mutations. But the new mango is a mango. The new mango carries some of the karma from the past. If the previous mango was sweet, it's very likely the new mango is sweet. If you were a good person in your last life, some of that will carry on to this life. If you've got strong endurance, like the mango resisted drought, you would have strong endurance in this life. If you were a mango before, you don't become an apple. So you do carry a lot of those traits and inclinations. That's karma. But there's nothing identical. If you take those two mangoes and try and find out what was there, it's just maybe it's mangoness, that's all, but nothing really essential goes through that process. It's like what someone once said, well, it could have been me, string of beads, one next to each other, but no actually string going through, linking them. Just cause and effect, beads next to each other, but nothing going through. Sometimes it appears that way, like in the old Mexican waves they used to do it. Do they still do Mexican waves at stadiums? You see a Mexican wave, all these people, one person stands up and the next person stands up at a football stadium. But it looks like something's going across. But nothing goes across. It just gives the appearance of that. And that is the appearance of what happens when we get reborn. Nothing goes across. Just one consciousness being the cause for the next consciousness. That's all. Bir Aja, there is no self. What is there? It's just this process. Are we a process of conditioned patterns and responses? Yes. Please elaborate. No. Elaborated already. It's a process. It's like the mango. One thing leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another. The cause and effect process. Even today I felt sleepy during meditation. I've been easy on myself, not pushing to wake up too early and so on. Why am I still sleepy? Am I lazy? Am I avoiding mindfulness at some level? And how to investigate before? You know, sometimes look at the quality of your sleep. Look what you're eating. And look, this room is, for me anyway, it's always really hot. So try, you know, changing the surroundings by going out into the cool or somewhere. Try to find different places to sleep. Breaking the habits. Don't always sit on the cushion. Sit sort of on a stool or on a chair or something. Change things, otherwise you just become creatures of habit. And it could be the habitual expectation of your mind that meditation is sleep. It would go away afterwards. Today, finally, I had a peaceful and joyous meditation. The nimitta has different forms and comes and goes easily. However, I was contented. Thank you for your 9-day retreat teaching and kindness at Jhanagrove. Forgive me all the wrong thought and wrong speech. Yeah, you see, it works for some people. Dear Ajahn Brahm, please answer this extremely truthfully. Can you read minds and can you tell if one is lying or not? Thank you very much. Dear Ajahn, as I told you, you're not allowed to say such things. All you say is that after a certain amount of meditation, when you get very deep, those things actually happen. You can read minds, but any monk who's ever read a mind only does it about one or two times, and they've had enough. Quite frankly, your minds aren't worth reading. Honestly. Is your mind really worth reading? Okay, that time when Ajahn Chah read my mind and I knew he was up to it. This is a good story, but I've told it many times before, but this is one of my favourite stories. It also shows how inspiration is so important to get really nice meditation. Don't look at the two bad bricks in the wall. Don't find fault. You can find fault with this retreat. You can find fault with me, with the nuns, with the people, with Bianca even. So you can find fault anywhere if that's your mind. So instead, look at the beautiful bricks in the wall. Look at the inspiration or the gratitude, the thanks. Because when Ajahn Chah started to get sickly, the monks at Wat Nana Chah, we met together. How can we help our teacher? Because he has a lot of gratitude towards Ajahn Chah. But also, how can we get him to come more often to teach us? And we came up with this amazing strategy which works so well. You know, monks like me had actually looked into the Vinaya, this is a monastic discipline, and really went into it and found out that in the time of the Buddha, 2500 years ago in the Ganges Valley in India, Most monasteries had saunas, fire rooms, where you went in there to sweat, for good for your health. So saunas were not invented in Sweden. They were in India 2,500 years ago. So we thought, let's build a sauna for Ajahn Chah. And maybe we could use it as well. I don't know why I wasn't into the saunas. It was hot enough already in Thailand. What do you want to build a sauna in Thailand for? It's always sweating all over the place. But anyway, I don't know what it was with the German monks. The German monks, they were always in the sauna. They put up the temperature and drove everyone else out. They were crazy. I don't know why. This was just the ones I knew. They had a reputation anyway. But all the other monks were sensible, all the other countries. But those German monks, crikey. But anyway, it worked really well. We built a sauna, invited Ajahn Chah over, and he would come once a week to get his sauna, but he gave a talk beforehand. We got like 1 hour every week, he'd give a Dhamma talk to the Western monks, and he'd have his sauna. And as I mentioned also, that often the talks were boring. But every now and again, he just hits the really sweet spot, and this was one of the sweetest talks. Oh, it was so inspiring. I could understand Thai at that time and his dialect. You've been with him for such a long time. And when he gave the talk afterwards, oh, just so uplifted. And there's many other monks there. They went off to do the duties, helping with his robes and towel and stuff. I decided to go behind the hall and to meditate. About, could have been 2 hours, an hour and a half, somewhere around there. A beautiful deep meditation. That's when you're really inspired. Oh, it's just no problem at all watching your breath and nimittas and stuff. It's just easy because your mind is so uplifted and energized. But then after I came out, the first thought was, I wonder if I can still do a service for my great teacher. So I got up, just really blissed out of my head, and just walked towards the sauna. And as I was walking, that I saw him coming the opposite direction on the path with two Thai people. One was the driver, the other an attendant. And I thought, I'd missed my chance. He'd finished his sauna. But, there's no turning back. So we're going to pass. And so, as he came closer, that's when my mind was so peaceful, so easy to know that he was inside my mind. He was reading it. It's a really weird experience because he feels someone inside. And that's all I can. I'm not making this up. That's just being extremely truthful. And he was reading my mind. But the nice thing was, I was so happy he was reading my mind. For once, my mind was pure and bright. Now's the time. Come and have a look. Yeah, see? Most times I would have really sort of run away. No, I don't want you to do this. I'd be embarrassed. But this time I was conceited and proud. Yeah, have a look, great teacher. And that's why I could feel him inside. I was very happy that he was inside. And maybe because after a really deep meditation you could have that ability. And then, sort of he looked at me really fiercely. And with kindly but very strong. And that's when he asked me, Brahma Wangsa, why? It was in Thai, Tamai. Why? And of course that's an unforgettable experience. Why? And then I said, I don't know. I was a very stupid monk. And, he laughed. I realized he was trying to enlighten me. He laughed his head off. That's why I learned, it never punishes you for being stupid. Never scolds you. But finds like stupidity so amusing. And we amused him so many times. That's how stupid we were. But then he screwed his face up again. And he asked a second time. He said, Brahma Wangsa, I'll tell you the answer. The answer to the question why. And I was so happy. It was the personal teaching. Just from a great monk. I was told that story to Ajahn Chah. So he's trying to get it in his book. But he would say, did that really happen? Are you sure it happened? You're not making up. So those are teachings you'll never ever forget. You can't change those sorts of teachings. They're seared into your memory. And he said, I'll tell you the answer. And I was so eager to hear from a great monk like Ajahn Chah, the answer to the question why. And he said, my me arai, my me arai. which, you know, ping pong, means there's nothing, there's nothing. That's the answer to the question, why there's nothing. Really pretty deep answer, but then the killer was, when he looked at me again, really fiercely, he said, Brahma Wangsa, do you understand? Do you understand? And I said, yes, yes. And he said, no, you don't. And that is, you felt so deflated, so uplifted, a private teaching, the deepest you can get, and then he just totally sort of nailed me. But it was a great teaching, so you always remember that. The answer to the question, why? There's nothing. Beautiful. There's nothing there. It's just a process. Nothing there. Emptiness, anatta, sunyata, whichever one you want to call it. There's nothing there. That's the answer to the question, why? Do you understand? But you will one day. Keep that in your mind because you get into deep meditation and that the memory of that anecdote comes up. And because it comes up automatically, you don't remember it on purpose. It's not through will. It comes up because it's in your subconscious now. And it comes up when it's ready and you understand what you meant. Brilliant, Ajahn Chah. Dear Ajahn, I'm so grateful for all you have or have not shared with us. Thank you. I am, however, having difficulty reconciling something you spoke of a few days ago. Uh-oh. Viz, being impossible to have good meditation if you are depressed. Did you mean a bit flat, low, or actual depression? Just because meditation is hopefully a pathway through depressive episodes are disappointing if not. Yeah, I'm talking about the real big meditations. So you get the small meditations, that takes you out of depression. It's very useful, that's why it's used for mild depressions. Very deep depressions, apparently psychologists, psychiatrists have told me, you do need medication. They don't really respond to meditation. But, you know, just the average depressions, meditation is incredibly powerful. So, ordinary meditations, you get better, better, better. But when you get to the really powerful stuff, really deep meditations, you get happiness anyway. And it's the happiness is the cause. The reason I say that, if you push away the happiness, thinking this has got nothing to do with meditation, or I don't deserve to be happy, which is one of the other reasons we push it away, then you're stopping yourself. It is really bliss upon bliss upon bliss. You may start from suffering, you may start from depression, but you lift up. They have this great simile, just like lotuses, they grow in the mud. Their roots are in the mud under the water, that's like depression. But it grows and grows and grows, still has its roots in the mud, grows and grows and grows until it goes through the water to the sunlight above. But it has to be growing up. If it grows down, it won't go. So it's not really impossible, but you know, you start, you can't sort of get deep meditation if you're depressed today, but you get out of depression in the afternoon, start getting happy and happier and happier, and then you get some deep meditations in the evening. In your cave, where does the ventilation come from? As the cave doesn't seem to have any holes or windows. Also, when do you usually go to sleep in your cave? Thank you. I go to sleep in my cave when I'm not meditating. And when I'm not meditating, I go to sleep. That's the only two things I do there. Don't take any books in there. Don't do any work in there. Because the next door is the office. That's where I do work. I've got showers in there. So that I reserve just for meditation and resting, nothing else. It's really important to have a place where you don't do too many things. Meditation. So if you have a cupboard in your house, just use it for meditation, don't use it for other things. A corner of your bedroom, a meditation room, that's amazing to have that. But don't just meditate anywhere. Have your space, build up the energy, like in Bodhinyana Monastery. And then it's good. Where does the ventilation come from? You don't need ventilation when you're in deep meditation, when you're not breathing. You don't need it. But you all know being in there, there is ventilation, you didn't see it. The inlet is a little, on the floor is a little wooden thing, and you can open it up and you can close it, that's where the air comes in. And the exit is just above the Buddha statue. You go underneath there, there's a little pipe going out. So it's actually very well ventilated. You don't need much if you're meditating there. If you're doing aerobics, yeah, I'll probably sort of die from lack of oxygen. But just meditating, you don't need much energy, it's just perfect amount. So that was actually an amazing design. So well done for the designers. Among the five senses, hearing seems to be the hardest one to disappear during meditation. Any good suggestions to overcome this problem? One possibility is if you live in a noisy place, is earplugs. I have some which I use on the aircraft to meditate. And it was one another monk told me about these, because in a place like Western Australia, so many people used to be working in the mines. And so because they were working in the mines, they developed these really high-tech earplugs. So I went to an audiologist, who's in Subiaco over here, and they squirted this liquid, you know, like silicon gel, into my ears, waited for it to set, now maybe 5 minutes, and then took them out afterwards, and they would use those as the molds. They sent them off, I think it was to Sydney, and a week later, you got the real things. They were molded to fit exactly into your ears. And I remember when they gave them to me, and the Anagarika sort of paid, she said, okay, now you won't have to wake up in the middle of the night because your wife snores. Because that's what they thought. That's, you know, if you're not working, it's because, you know, someone is snoring next to you. So, but, you know, I couldn't really explain to her, I'm a monk, you don't have wives. And not even one wife, I said wives. But the first time I tried them, it was an amazing experience. I was in the aircraft going to somewhere or other, put them in my ears, and started to meditate, and I fell fast asleep. And really effective. So I was obviously tired. And so I fell fast asleep, and that's the first time I've ever slept that well on an aircraft. And when I came out of sleep, wanted to go to the toilet, and as I was walking to the toilet down the aisle of the aircraft, you know the thought, how stupid I am, the thought was, wow, this aircraft is really quiet. And I didn't realize I still had my earplugs in. They were that effective, you don't know they're in there. They're so comfortable. So I showed those to, was it Posada the other day? You know, if you ever, what's the Posada? Tiny little things. And I carry them everywhere. And they're brilliant. If you're in a noisy place, because I don't know where I'm going to sleep next. I travel around so much. It's really noisy. You put them in, you get a great night's sleep, great meditation. Basically, they really keep out a lot of noise, and they're so comfortable. You don't know they're in there. So that's in today's world, practical thing to do. Otherwise, you just don't put the noise in the center of your screen. Keep the whatever else it is, the breath, beautiful breath, and nimitta in the center of your screen. You can hear the sound, but it's like a long way away. How can pass our ghost stories to you? Can we email those? Yeah, you can use my Gmail account. The ghost mail account. No, just write them down. They're the best ways. A lot of people have ghost stories, and most of the ghost stories are very beautiful stories. They're not scary at all. Usually the fake ones are the scary ones. Like this woman here in Perth, she told me that her husband had died a long time ago, and she was living with her dog, and the dog was like best friend. So she was devastated when her dog died, really grieved. But she would hear the dog barking in the house. But she could never actually see the dog. She could hear it, and she'd open the door, there's no dog there. But she could hear it clearly, and not just imagination. She knew the sound of her dog, and it was just so clear, but couldn't ever see it. But before the dog died, she was taking it for a walk in the forest, and as she was walking and playing with the dog, only when she got back, she found she'd lost her fingering in the forest. She knew roughly where it was lost. So she went back with her dog, search. But you know, with all the leaf litter and twigs, if you lose something like a ring, you never find it. So, she gave up on that. A few days later, the dog died. And then one day, she heard the dog barking, right outside the front door, the entrance door of her house. And she was just on the other side of it. So she thought, I've got him, I can get it this time. So she opened the door, no dog there. But right in the middle of the welcome mat was her finger ring. The dog found it for her. You know, she'd been in and out of the house for days. It only just appeared on the welcome mat, just with the barking of the dog. And that's the last time she heard her dog. The dog found the fingering for her. It's such a beautiful story. The last little gift the dog could give to its owner, its best friend. That was beautiful. And when she told me the story, she was so much smiles. A beautiful end to a wonderful relationship. May I know the manufacturer of these comfy meditation chairs? Not sure if they can export to my overseas home. Actually, they came from Malaysia, those chairs are sitting in, but I don't know what the manufacturer is now. You can maybe ask who got them for us. I can't remember now. But anyway, you can actually take the measurements. We had the measurements specially made, so sometimes the chairs are too high and your legs dangle over. Sometimes they're too low and you don't know what to do with your legs. So, you know, we were actually, I think actually Bianca might know. Do you remember where we got the meditation chairs from, Burr?
Yeah.
You do? There you go. There we go. But I went there to check quite a few to make sure they were just nice. Not too soft, not too hard. Dear Ajahn, I think you do a disservice to the hens. Admittedly, she is mindful. This is hens sitting on the eggs. But in mundane sense, not harming any eggs under her. I bet if you do her job, you break every egg underneath you. If they're my eggs, they'll be much bigger and that was not me doing a disservice. That was Ajahn Chah. That was his story. Just sitting long, it's just like hens sitting on a bunch of eggs. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what is the difference between a centipede and a millipede? Thank you. The difference is the amount of time it takes them to put their shoes on and to take them off before they go in the dining room. And that's the last question of this retreat. Oh, what a downer. That's what I'm going to remember. What's the difference between a centipede and a millipede? Look it up on Wikipedia or something. No need to ask me. But anyway, it's 9:30 now. One of the reasons. Some of these questions have been very deep and profound, and thank you for asking them. Some have been a little bit of entertainment, telling a few funny stories. That's on purpose, because by the end of the day, many people get sleepy. And I remember as a young lay Buddhist going to listen to talks in London and other places and falling fast asleep because the teachers were so boring. And everything they said I could read in a book so easily. Just like, I don't know if I told this story, actually this came from Mahinda, I think I did this the first day, would I? About in a temple, the monk was giving the talk on the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path starts with Samadhi, followed by Samasankappa, followed by Samavaja. The next one is Samakamanta. And the mind was, his mind went blank, said, what's the next one? And someone in the audience says, Bhante, some are sleeping. So that's, I know that, you've seen that. People, and I did it myself. I thought I was a Buddhist, I should go listen to the talks, and they're so boring. So, every now and again, I got this from a Tibetan monk. He said, when you tell a joke, everyone's mouths are open, and that's when you can pop the pill of the Dhamma in. It's so true, because when you tell a joke, a funny story, people are actually paying attention. And that's actually when you can teach something. And then when I look around and see you're getting bored again, your head goes down, you're not really paying attention. Another funny story, and now I can teach some more Dhamma. It's a brilliant observation of how to teach. So the funny stories and the jokes are not just done without real consideration of how teaching happens. You've got to be alert, awake. You may think you're listening to the next joke, but then I can put the Dhamma in. You're paying attention. But too much, and then some are sleeping. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That was your joke, wasn't it, Mahinda? The sun was sleeping. Yeah, it was, yeah. It was a brilliant one. Well done. Okay, have a nice night. If you haven't got enlightened yet, Ananda method of enlightenment beckons. Let go. Thank you.